because we worry that the women would be harmed.
Could I interrupt you?
Go ahead. We're worried, of course, that the women would be harmed. Now, they had roadblocks all around. And I've never heard of a roadblock resulting in any captures, but I guess they have someplace sometime. These were unsuccessful. And that morning early, that is the morning following the afternoon of the escape, early, the women called the Detroit police on the telephone in Detroit and told them where they were, and the police quickly came and got the two women, who said that they'd been treated fine all the way into Detroit and that they were put out of the car by the four men near this telephone. So the search then centered, concentrated in Detroit. Now these four convicts were all long-termers, and they'd all been in prison before, and they were pretty rough characters. The papers were all working hard on it because of the interest by the people in Detroit in what happened to the convicts. Did they keep on going out of Detroit, or were they still in the city? If they're in the city, would they be have a particular menace to the people of Detroit? The automobile that they stole in Jackson was found in Detroit, but no sign of the men. So I got a call, and a man told me, I knew the man. He told me where three of the four escapees were in Detroit. They had moved in with a man and his wife and their two very small children, like about 4 and 3 years old. The man had served a lot of time in prison, man of the house. It was a small house on an out-of-the-way street on the west southwest side of Detroit. So he, of course, my informant, was afraid that he, you know, wanted to protect his anonymity, and said he knew that if it ever got out that where the information came from, he'd be killed. I told him it wouldn't get out. But I wouldn't tell anybody, that we'd just go out and look into this place and see if they're there. He was very specific. He'd been with them in that house, and he knew they didn't have any guns. He said they wouldn't have any guns in the house because of two small children. But they had knives that they had made in prison, and he told me just where each knife was. They had three of them. He said one of the four had stolen a car and taken off. He didn't know where he was headed, but he did know about the others. So I got the chief of detectives, and he picked some men that I had confidence in that wouldn't tip off any other newspaper, and that he knew were all good policemen. So I had a photographer, two photographers, another reporter, and I then went out with the police. Our car had a telephone in it, and they surrounded the house and then went in. And they were all there. The three of them were there. I've had so many bad tips that I was pleasantly surprised, really, to see that this one was turning out. They didn't resist in any way. And police arrested all of them. And there was no other newspaper there. I had phoned the whole thing, and we took pictures and sent them in. And the police took quite a long time searching the house. And they drove back to the station, to the headquarters with the prisoners, slowly. And by the time, shortly after I got back to headquarters, no, before I got back to headquarters, our paper, our extra, had come up. Had come to the police station with the whole story and the pictures in it, which just about caused the reporters in our opposition papers to have a heart attack because they didn't know anything about this. however, in the meantime, I had some people from our paper drive my informant up to Saginaw, where he had relatives, and where nobody knew him except his relatives, because we wanted to give him every protection that we could, and he was comfortable up there. It was a pretty good story, and we felt good about it. But our next obligation, of course, was to be sure that nobody found out where we got the information. And I was sure that nobody would find that out until the police called me late one day and says, "Hey, some guy's down on Michigan Avenue in Skid Row in a bar telling everybody he's the one who tipped you off as to where these fellows were hiding." I said, "What's his name?" And he gave it to me, and it was a shock because that was the name of the fellow. So I went right down there with the police, and sure enough, it was my man that we were trying to protect. He was drunk. See, we gave him some money for this trip, and it went to his head. So they took him back to headquarters to sort of protective custody, I guess, so he couldn't talk so much. And he was telling everybody there about it, too. The ironical part of it was that we were so afraid that inadvertently, only one or two people on the paper or police knew where I got the information, that it inadvertently might come out. And we were sincerely worried. Did everything we could to keep it from happening, and he's the guy who stole the beans. However, nothing happened to him, I'm happy to report. I saw him many years later. Well, I've been in touch with him over the years, but last time I saw him was a few years ago, and he was still healthy, a little bit crazy. I always thought he was a little crazy. Certainly after he had a couple of drinks. But he said he'd never been had any harassment from that at all, that people might mention it to him, but he never was threatened, even let alone hurt. But it could have been close, and he would have had, as they say, himself only to blame.
Was there a standard tipster fee that the newspapers paid?
No, not as far as we're concerned. I don't think the others did. Had a standard either. We often didn't pay people anything. They didn't expect it. It's just a matter of their cooperating. And while I know that a lot of people think the newspaper buy their stories, it doesn't happen that way. A lot of people are willing, anxious really, to cooperate. And I don't remember how much he was paid. I remember one thing, that the state prisons, or the state of Michigan, has a standing reward of $150 for information leading to the capture of any escaped felon. Well, they said, "What will we who we make the check out to, and I said, make it out to me. So I, let's see, it'll be $4.50 for three of them. So I cashed the check and gave my tipster the money, and of course I got a receipt from him. So I think in the records of the state of Michigan, it shows that I got the reward. But no, he got that, and he got money from us. I don't remember how much we gave him, but it would be, I'm sure it was at least that much. It's probably $500. Although he wasn't looking for the money. He didn't bring up the money that I recall at all. He just had some information. He had to give it to somebody, and he knew me, and he gave it. He, of course, had been in prison. Maybe that helped him be a little bit crazy, and as I always thought he was, many people, when they come out, do seem a bit odd, and it's no wonder because of the horrible way they have to live while in prison. I recall one story in the Upper Peninsula. Marquette Prison has around 1,500 inmates. It's very far north in Michigan. It's considered a tough prison. And one reason for that is that the men up there rarely see, if they have families, rarely see them because it's so difficult for the families to get up there, particularly in the cold months of the year, because it's far north. And the planes and the trains are next to impossible. So that's one of the hardships, as well as the prison itself. Well, this one man had served about 12 years on a robbery charge and was paroled. He went to a nearby small town, and a school, rather young school teacher, saw him walking along the road, and they're all friendly up there in the small towns. She didn't know, of course, that he had just been released from prison. He asked for a ride, and she picked him up in her car to be friendly, and he, when they were going through this desolate part of the country, he killed her. It was a sex crime. It didn't take the authorities long to figure out, since they found her body, which was very shortly after the murder itself, figure out who did it. And nor did it take long to find him and arrest him, because there are not many places to hide up there. Pardon me. I flew up on the story, and he was then in the county jail. It was attached to the sheriff's house, or vice versa. And he was a lone prisoner in their detention, in the detention part of the jail, or in the jail itself. So he didn't want to talk to me at all, but I knew a lot of inmates at Marquette and broke the ground by asking him what they were doing, what their jobs were. And when he saw that I knew a lot and sort of spoke the language, the barriers were removed, and he told me what he had done. He'd admitted that he killed a girl anyway. Told me what he had done, and he said, but I'm not going back to that joint. Often prisoners refer to the prison as the joint. He said, I'm just not going back. I said, well, how are you going to manage that? He said, I want to do the Brody. I'd never heard the term used that way before. He meant he was going to commit suicide. And he showed me a piece of very finely honed stone that was razor sharp. And before he told me this, he made me promise that what he was going to tell me would be in complete confidence. So as soon as he told me that, I thought, well, now what do I do? The sheriff was a real cooperative, decent guy. What was my duty as a newspaper man? It was, should I tell the sheriff and break my confidence to him? Maybe save his life. Maybe he wasn't going, maybe this was just a bluff. Maybe he wasn't going to anyway, although I thought he was going to try to take his life. Was I going to let the sheriff get the blame for neglecting his prisoner? There's a problem. I kicked it around a little while and went to the sheriff and said, hey, what do you do when you get a guy that's so badly wanted for a capital crime in your jail? Do you have somebody in there all night with them? Or it looks like something, you know, this wouldn't be too hard a place to get out of. The sheriff said, no, he said, we don't. He said, there won't be any trouble. He said, got to go out and pick up so-and-so for non-payment of alimony. And he'll be in there at night, and he's a good fella. He'll watch him. And he says, then there's another one that I got to pick up. I've known him at the school. I've known him all my life, too. And he said, he'll keep an eye on him. No, he says, everything will be all right. So I said, well, I just wondered because he's pretty, you know, it's a mandatory life sentence if he should ever go to trial and found guilty of killing this girl. Well, he said, no, I thought there were any danger, but he said, I've got two good men, and I know they won't sleep. They'll be up kibitzing all night. So I then went to the state police and said, look, I'm going to be in such, introduce myself and told them what motel I'd be in. And I said, now, my newspaper expects a reporter when he's out of town to get everything of any news value at all that happens near where he's staying. So if you have even anything during the night, even a small automobile accident, call me and tell me about it. And they agreed to. They were very friendly. I knew, of course, that if anything happened at the jail, I'd get in touch with the state police immediately. So I thought I was covered that way. So I went to sleep pretty late. I went to sleep then for a few hours and got up early and went over to the jail. And just as I got to the jail...
Excuse me, Rick. Didn't you have to call your office and explain why you were staying over?
Yeah. I had originally planned to fly back that afternoon after I talked to this man and gotten some more details of the story. But since he told me what he was going to do, I changed my plans and called my office. Now, I know in a small town, the operator... Particularly when something like that happens, the operators, they have a chance to listen in, particularly on a call to a newspaper. They hear what's the latest. They're not supposed to, but many do. And I had to be very careful what I said. So I talked to the man on our city desk, and I said, look, I'm staying over. This guy tells me, meaning the prisoner, he's going to do the Dutch tonight. Now, that's a slang expression for commit suicide, but it's certainly a telephone operator up in the woods of northern Michigan wouldn't know that expression. Not many people do. It's an underworld term, and not many people know it, do the Dutch. And this, I could have strangled this man because he didn't understand it. I just thought anybody who worked on a newspaper any length of time would know what I was talking about. He didn't understand it. I repeated it. Finally, I said, "Skip it. I'll see you tomorrow. And I'll be here tonight." So then when I did get up in the morning, then it was early, I went right to county jail. Just as I drove up, two men were carrying someone on a stretcher out to the ambulance, out of the jail. Of course, it was my friend. He had cut his wrist badly. Neither of the other prisoners had detected anything until he was almost dead. But they got help in time, just a little while before I got there. Got help in time, took him to the hospital, sewed him up, and he later was sentenced to life in prison, and that's where he is now, back in Marquette.
The other day, Ray, we were talking about reporters who drink, and I understand there are some other stories that have come to mind.
Yeah, it seems to be an occupational hazard. I don't think it is so much anymore. But yes, there are many that come to mind. One, night that I recall distinctly, I ran into another reporter and one of the area's top hoodlums. He was once designated as public enemy number one. If it is a mafia, he was reputed to be very high in its ranks. He had amassed quite a bit of money through both gambling and bootlegging. And this, they had a few drinks before I met them. I had a few drinks with them. They asked me to go to some cabaret, and so I got in the car that the other newspaper man owned and was driving. But when we're headed towards the east side of Detroit and going through a particularly dark part of the city and rough part of the city, and the driver was driving, as they say, erratically all over the street. He was much drunker than I thought he was when I got in. So I said, "Look, Jack, let me drive. You're tired." And he said, "Fine." Now his acceptance of my offer, his ready acceptance, should have made me suspicious. But it didn't. I got out of my side of the car, started to walk around, and he drove off. Well, I was alone. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. There wasn't a thing open with a telephone in it. There were just large and scruffy characters in shadows. I was pretty sure I'd be robbed before I got out onto a main street. But fortunately, a cab did come along. He must have been lost. I had him drive me downtown. And I went to a bar that stayed open late, and I was waiting for this. I thought this other newspaper man would show up there later, and I wanted to kill him for leaving me in that spot. Well, it developed somebody else wanted to, too, because I talked to this so-called hoodlum, called me the next day, and he said, "Are you all right?" I said, "Yeah, but why didn't you stop that man?" He said, "I couldn't stop him. He said, you don't know the whole story. He said, he drove about 6 blocks right smack into a gas station, slammed on the brakes. When the attendant came over, he said, this is a stick-up. He said, if the police had come, I'd have gotten 100 years in prison. He said, I jumped out of the car and ran all the way home. It could have had a very serious consequence indeed. He, and incidentally, the driver, had very little recollection of this when I talked to him about it. I don't know if that was by design or if he really didn't remember much about it. But he professed not to. He was the same one that I should have known enough to stay miles away from him when he was drinking. But one night, several of us from the three papers in Detroit attended a party that was given by a bootlegger who had been kidnapped and paid $25,000, the standard rate, for his release. The kidnap ring was rounded up later on, many years later on, and the last of them was convicted. So this man gave a party in his home for those of us who had been covering the trial. At 2 or 3 in the morning, it was a nice party in his home. At 2 or 3 in the morning, 3 of us left together. One, the same guy who had left me on the east side, and another one I knew pretty well, another friend. The one who had left me stranded before he told the gas station owner it was a stick-up, was pretty tight. He had way too much to drink. So I said to my friend, come on, get in the car and put him in. We'll take him home. So I got in the car and I said, where do you live? We'll drive you home. He said, screw you. So I said, well, look, it's late. So I got to go to work in the morning. And I knew he'd moved, and I knew he'd moved out a long ways from where we were. So I said, tell me where you live. Let's be nice about it. We'll drive you home. And he said, screw you. So this time, I was on a main street, and I saw a policeman in uniform walking the beat, headed in we're headed towards each other. So I stopped the car and said to the other fellow with me, who was sober, let's throw him out and let him lie there, and we'll tell a cop to get the address. So we did that. We threw the drunkenman out of the car, drove up to the policeman, explained our trouble to him, and I said, I'll drive around the block, and then I'll get back, and by that time, you'll have his address for us. So the cops said, fine, that's good. Don't leave them, though. I hate them sleeping on my sidewalks. I said, no, we'll get them. We'll be right back. So we came back, and the policeman had this guy on his feet, put him back in the car, and he says, he lives at so-and-so, giving us the address. So we thanked him very much and started to drive off. And I'd driven several blocks and said to the third one, I said, what was that address again that he gave me, that he gave you for this guy? And he says, he didn't give me any address. He said, didn't you hear it? I said, no, you were sitting right next to him. I thought you had it. He said, hell, you're driving. I didn't pay any attention to it. So neither of us knew what the address was. We were just as bad off as we had been. So we proceeded in the general, we knew the general area, and it was way out, the outskirts of the city. So when we got out, where there was no building, no nothing but fields, I said, let's throw him out again. We'll drive around a little bit, and by the time we come back, he'll be so shaken up by being alone here that he'll be glad to tell us where he lives. I was a great psychologist. Thank you, man. So we drove and drove and came back and drove some more and couldn't find him. He'd wandered off. We looked for him quite a while. Finally said, the hell with it. It was a nice summer's night. So, and it was morning, I should say. So we had time for about an hour's sleep if we went right downtown before we were due at work. So I went down, this other fellow lived in the hotel. I went to his room. I was going to stay with him that night. And we just got in, the phone rang. And it was the fellow that we'd, no, it was the police in the precinct near where we had left this man. And they said, do you know this guy? We said, Craig, yeah, we know him. Where is he? And he said, well, we had him locked up. He was swinging at somebody's porch swing in a house apparently near where you left him off. So we said, well, look, we told him who he was and said, well, you have golden rule on them and so we can get some sleep. That means they just keep him until early morning and let him sleep until he's sober enough and then let him go home.
He actually was being held on an attempted B&E.
Yeah, that's right. The people whose porch swing he was enjoying thought to call the police frantically, thinking a legion, I guess, of burglars were trying to break into their house and the noise he was making. So the cruiser came, that's a four-man car, and grabbed him and threw him in the back and sat on him until they got him to station. But he was one to avoid when he had a drink. There are several like that. Of course, you'd get to know, but sometimes circumstances would just throw you into a spot like that. I knew better than to try to do him a favor by driving him home. You know, he's like a psychopath, that when he was drinking, you try to help him, and you come away bleeding with your clothes torn, no matter what. It's the same as a true psychopath. He acts normally, you think he's all right, but he's in trouble. You go to help him, and you wind up with a broken arm, with your clothes torn and bleeding, and he goes on his way just as gaily and happy as anyone that realizing or caring that he leaves another one suffering in his wake.
I should have thought of it sooner.
The same kind of thieves.
Ray, at one time, newsmen knew professional criminals and could relate to them and could do business with them. Isn't that correct?
Well, by doing business, we'll have to explain
that
term.
Let's put that in quotation.
Some of us were, it was our job to know criminals as well as police. I mean, just as a society reporter knows people in society, or as a sports writer knows the professional athletes, those of us who specialize in crime knew the cops and the robbers, both sides of it. So we often We had a rapport with both sides, and I think those of us who had it, the trust of both sides, had it because they had complete confidence that we wouldn't betray a confidence. And I never have. And I know other newsmen who never have betrayed a confidence. And I think this is one of the most important things that a newspaper person who deals in important breaking stories has to live up to. Criminals will tell me many things that they wouldn't tell other people, and I never would repeat it, or repeat where it came from at least. On the other hand, the police would tell me many things in confidence, and they knew I wouldn't repeat it, and I didn't. But they helped me in writing stories for background material, for knowing when things were going to break, for having the stuff ready for the time that it would be printable. And we, of course, I can think of several things that, for instance, on different occasions, several newspaper people, including me, were able to get back things that had been stolen in burglaries. One friend who had his house burglarized and lost a lot of valuable, both jewels and silverware, came to me about it. Of course, he reported it to the police, but I was able to put out enough feelers so that the stuff was returned, and it was customary to give the person who had stolen it an amount of money, just a courtesy thing, because it took him some time to steal it, and you paid him for that time, and showed you appreciated it. That often happened, and I say often happened, it happened frequently.
Well, those kinds of contacts were also helpful in getting fellow newsmen out of jams, weren't they?
Yeah, I, one serious one, a friend took his wife and children for the summer vacation to the northern woods of Michigan and left them in this log cabin, went right to Hurley, Wisconsin, when it was a wide open town. And he lost money gambling. He started to drink. Lost a lot of money. Wrote a lot of bad checks. And that's not a healthy thing to do in a town like that, because the gamblers don't take kindly to receiving bad checks or to having the debts welched in. He called the office, and they in turn got in touch with me, and he said he's in big trouble up there, knowing the kind of people that might be in and out of there. Something might happen to him. Well, I was able, at that time, I knew somebody who had a connection in Hurley. We found that he owed $3,000, so the office magnanimously advanced that amount of money to him. We sent it up there to settle his gambling debts, and while he'd never been held, he really wasn't free to leave town. The money arrived, and he got an escort out of the city and back to his family, a very friendly escort. No harm befell him. However, he was in deep trouble, because those people just don't take to that sort of thing. Fortunately, we knew who to get in touch with, who knew somebody. a great deal of successful newspaper work was in knowing people, in knowing, you know, who to call in for any given situation, or who would know the answer to any particular difficult question or problem. And we spent a lot of years cultivating contacts.
That's harder to do these days, isn't it, Ray, because of the changing nature of crime?
The whole nature has changed. I don't know really anything about it anymore because it's changed. So, for instance, factory workers go out in their lunch hour and rob a bank. Burglars, big burglaries, are being committed by 14, 15-year-old kids. They're robbery armed. These crimes are not planned like they used to be. They're done habitually, without any reason. They'll rob somebody at the point of the gun, and get $8, and they can spend 20 years in prison for that. It used to be that a criminal, before he'd go with a gun to hold up either an individual or a place of business or a bank, would have the whole thing cased, to use that term, their term, that is figured out ahead of time, right down to the amount of money, and he knew about what he'd get, and how long it would take, and what if it were not cash, where he'd dispose of the stolen property, where it would be fenced. But now it's a hit or miss thing, and there's so many involved in it that it doesn't make sense, and I don't know who anymore is doing what. It used to be that you'd see a crime, and you often could tell by the MO, by the way it was done, just about who did it. Now that wouldn't mean, and the police knew this, but that wouldn't mean they could go and arrest and convict him. Because while you might know this is the way he always committed a crime, you couldn't show that he was the one who committed that crime. Willie Sutton, for instance, who just recently was released from prison down in 70, one of the most publicized bank robbers, and one of the most scientific. Usually it could be determined that he was the one who held up a bank by the manner in which he did it and the amount of money, which was always big, that he got. But the police couldn't necessarily prove that. So while he did serve a lot of time in prison, he robbed a lot of banks that he never was arrested or even questioned about. But the whole thing, it was more of a science. They took pride in their work. Safe blowers took pride in their work. Pickpockets took pride in their work. Stick-up men did. Even auto thieves. Now an auto thief is usually a 14-year-old kid. But who wants a joyride? But the old auto thieves made a lot of money out of it because it'd be rings. They steal a car and either resell it in another state or strip it and sell the parts. It was a good livelihood.
Do you think it's just part of a larger pattern of a breakdown in confidence or pride and craft?
Yeah, we don't make things as well as we used to, so we don't do our crimes as well. We're in too much of a hurry. We've lost the craftsmanship. We've lost the pride in many of our fields of endeavor, including, I'm afraid, crime.
Ray, what are the implications of the kind of special access a crime reporter had in some criminal quarters to being police commissioner at a later point in your career?
Well, not many of those people are around anymore, but this was kind of interesting. When I left the newspaper business, I became head of the probation department, criminal courts, for all the criminal courts in Detroit. Now, I sort of thought that these people I knew that were in the underworld would, I know they all must have had a cousin or a friend or somebody in going through the courts, therefore, probation reports, and I thought that they'd be, some of them would call me for favors. I never got one request in all that time for any favor from any of them. I worked in, as executive in the mayor's office for a year and a half and never got one request for a favor of any kind from any of those people. I was police commissioner for 4 years and 7 months, and I never got one request. Not only didn't I get any request, but I never heard anything from them. I haven't to this day, and this is, I've been out of the police commissioner's office since, 3 years now, and I haven't even heard them. Wouldn't bother me. I like to think it's because they had enough respect for me that they wouldn't ask any favors. I did run into a few at a funeral home one night, and I think I was working in the mayor's office then, and in the funeral home I saw some of them and said, where have you been? I haven't seen you. And they said, no, we certainly wouldn't want to burn you up. We'll stay away. And that was the only contact.